Thank you for listening to this sermon from Seven Springs Presbyterian Church. If you want to learn more about us, please find us on Facebook or visit us at sevenspringspresbyterian.com.
So now we turn to 1 Samuel chapter 8. And last week we looked at the end of an era with the judges. Now the book of Judges ended before 1 Samuel began, but the period of the judges really had not come to that complete end of that cycle that we looked at last week. And really, this really was a transition period. And today, we now look to that shift of that new beginnings, that new chapter. And we first start with a problem. And this is in verses 1 to 3. When Samuel became old, he made his sons judges over Israel. The name of his firstborn son was Joel, and the name of his second, Abijah. And they were judges in Beersheba. Yet his sons did not walk in the ways, but turned aside after gain. They took bribes and perverted justice. Now we have a cycle from the heights of chapter 7, where Israel was worshiping their true living God, the rightly, correctly, that put away all these high places and had turned back to worship God underneath Samuel. This time, this height, one of the only times in the period of Israel, this church underage, where they actually truly worshiped God. You can only think of maybe but on a handful of Hezekiah, of Ezra, Nehemiah, Josiah, of where they actually truly turned to the Lord and worshiped Him correctly. But now we begin in chapter 8. It doesn't take us long. Samuel rules, but the next generation comes in. Now we find that Samuel is old. This reminds us again that 1 Samuel really is a book of contrasts. That 1 Samuel is then compared to Eli. Eli was old. We saw that in the beginning chapters. But his sons had become judges. Now, this request is not a new request. This having their sons be judges. In Judges chapter 8, they actually came to Gideon and said, "Rule over us, you and your son and your grandson also, for you have saved us from the hand of Midian." But Gideon turned to them and said in Judges 8:23, "I will not rule over you, and my son will not rule over you. The Lord will rule over you." So this passing on the baton of sons, but they did not live up to their names. Joel means Yahweh is God. And Abijah means my father is Yahweh. But they did not follow in their father's footsteps. They did not walk in his ways, but they turned aside after gain. So they were judges, but they were unjust. They took bribes and perverted justice, it said. And Deuteronomy 16:18-20 actually speaks of judges and the law. It says that you shall appoint judges and officers in your towns the Lord your God is giving you, according to your tribes. And they shall judge the people with righteous judgment. You shall not pervert justice. You shall not show partiality. You shall not accept a bribe, for a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and subverts the cause of the righteous. Justice, and only justice, shall follow, that you may live and inherit the land the Lord your God is giving you. We saw Eli's sons following in this perverted sense of that they were meant to be priests, but they were not holy. And now we find two sons that were meant to be judges, but they weren't just. Again, we see the corrupt nature and the dark times that we find ourselves in the nation of Israel, that chapter 7 is very short-lived, that sin is forever crouching at your door, ready to come in. I'm sure Samuel would have sat down and told the story, which is written in 1 Samuel, told him about the sons of Eli and what they did and what happened to Eli's household. Remember that first vision that he got where the Lord spoke to him. the nighttime where he called out three times and then go to Eli. However, it was the Lord that was speaking. But his two sons maybe would just roll their eyes, wouldn't really care. Speak of the destruction of the house of Eli. But his sons were oblivious to it. Now the motif of two sons, I think, is an important one that I haven't really found a lot of people writing on it. But we see this throughout the Old Testament of these two sons coming up. And these two sons, maybe one is righteous and one is unrighteous. One is holy, one is chosen by the Lord, and another is not. Or two sons that completely walk away from the Lord. You think of Cain and Abel. You think of that right at Genesis chapter 4, Ishmael and Isaac, Esau and Jacob, Manasseh and Ephraim, Joseph's son, Gershom and Eliezer, Moses' sons, Abihu and Anadab, Aaron's sons, Hophni and Phinehas, and now Joel and Abijah. These themes that flow through show us this pattern that just because the father or the parents are chosen or righteous or holy doesn't necessarily mean that it flows down the line. This is what we call the two seeds. The two seeds, which is given to us in Genesis, right at the beginning, the seed of the serpent and the seed of the woman. That just because you have physical offspring doesn't mean that they're spiritual offspring. That two sons might come from the same woman, even the same womb at the same time, Esau and Jacob. However, that they're not both chosen by God. Esau, I hated, Jacob, I loved. And sometimes you see this balance of one son being the seed of the serpent and another being the seed of the woman or the seed of promise. However, sometimes you see the seed in the generations, that Samuel is a righteous man who follows after Yahweh, who does what Yahweh commands. However, his sons do not. They walk wickedly. They walk with perverted justice. So Samuel is clearly a man of God, but his sons did not walk in his ways. And I think this is an important thing. It doesn't really speak about Samuel's parenting style. It doesn't explain his parenting. I heard one preacher try and explain that Samuel was not a good parent because he was too busy judging Israel. I don't necessarily get that sense from the text. Maybe you could make a mild argument, but I think what we need to understand is there's not a gospel, prosperity gospel of parenting. Parenting isn't something that you input these exact qualifications, these exact methods, and therefore you get a seed of the woman. That it doesn't always work like that. Now, I think that the Bible does teach us how to be a parent. It does equip us well to do that, to be able to instruct and teach the children in the way of the Lord, to be able to teach them to fear the Lord. But even if you do that, it doesn't necessarily mean it's a guaranteed slam dunk that it necessarily is going to perfectly happen. We are called to instruct our children in the way of the Lord, to raise them as covenant children. However, views of sovereignty do not change when it comes to parenting. So I think that's very important to see that in the beginning chapters, we start with a huge problem that Samuel has two sons, and those two sons are not judging like Samuel was. The baton wasn't passed on. Then we come now, not from a problem, but a demand. This is how Israel wishes to deal with this problem. And this is the demand is found in verses 4 to 9. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah and said to him, "Behold, you are old and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint to us a king to judge us like all the nations." But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, "Give us a king to judge us." And Samuel prayed to the Lord. And the Lord said to Samuel, "Obey the voice of the people in all that they say to you. For they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them. According to all the deeds that they have done, from that day I brought them out of Egypt, even to this day, forsaking me and serving other gods. So they are also doing to you. Now then, obey their voice. Only you shall solemnly warn them and show them the ways of the king who shall reign over them. The irony is found here in this. They have this problem. Their sons are not following what the Lord says. But they come to him with a solution. Now give us a king like the other nations. The irony is that they're not actually following what the Lord has told them to do, that they've actually rejected God themselves. Again, this passing on of leadership. Normally when you have a good godly leader, then it flows through. Wherever you have a wicked leader, it's very rare to see the opposite take place. So they have this irony, and they ask for a king to judge us like the other nation. And this is the big problem that we've looked at from the beginning, at the end of Judges, now to this period. In those days, there was no king in Israel, and everyone did what was right in their own eyes. This is kind of what it's been leading up to. Give us a king. There's no king, but here's the solution. We need a king like all the other nations. Or even in Hannah's prayer, she prays that he will give strength to his king and exalt the horn of his anointed. This raises a question, are kings bad? I think you see the eldership as a concept which runs through Sinai to the New Testament. There's a basic error that we have thought that the office of the king in the Old Testament is seen as wicked because of this request. I think, therefore, kingship is not in line with God's design for his people is kind of the connection a lot of people make. However, I think it's incorrect to say that this isn't in line of what God has designed. God had these offices in place. And this is not the first time that we've heard or thought of a king. And I'll just try and go through and look at why I think this office of king is nothing new that happens just in 1 Samuel 8. But we'll try and go quickly throughout it. First, we see it in the garden, that Adam is a king in the garden. This is a part of what we call the creation mandate in Genesis chapter 1, 28 and following, that Adam is there. We see Adam as kind of a prophet, as a priest, and also a king. And Adam was a ruler, and he was to have dominion over all the creatures as a vice regent. So I think we see this in the garden, that Adam is king. We see it also with the patriarchs. Firstly, with Abraham. In Genesis 17 and 16, he says, I will bless her, and moreover, I will give her a son by her. I will bless her, and she shall become nations. Kings of peoples shall come from her. That right from Genesis, when Abraham promised in 17, the sign of circumcision comes, and it says that kings will come from her. So a part of the promise. In Genesis 35:11, he says that, and kings shall come from your own body. And then Judah in 49:10, the scepter shall not depart from Judah. A scepter is a sign of a king ruling. Israel also is told, when we look at in Exodus, that a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. We see this concept of a kingship, of a kingdom, that Israel was founded as a kingdom, as a nation. Or even in the law of God, in Deuteronomy 17 and 18, it deals with the office of a prophet, a priest, and also a king. Deuteronomy 17:14-20 explains that a king will be set over you, whom God will choose, one from among your brothers. But the important verse there is in verse 18, where it says, write for yourself a copy of the law approved by the Levitical priests. He shall keep the law so that he may not turn aside from the law to the right or to the left. I think that we see the institution of a monarchy within the bounds of how God had established the nation of Israel, that it was in the will of God. But I think that we see this concept and the characteristics really clearly laid down, that it was to be one of the covenanted people, that they weren't meant to be greedy, that Scripture shall be his guiding light, that he is underneath the authority of God. He doesn't become a king and just have all the power. He is like a vice regent underneath God. God is his king. He shall copy the law in front of these priests, that similar to the structure in America with, you know, the Supreme Court, the Senate, the President, all these, they have functions of themselves and with checks and balances. This is kind of what the functions of the kings are, that the priests were there to serve and the prophets were there to proclaim the Word of God. And the priests were there to, they all had their roles and functions and to serve as checks and balances to point each other to God. But it was special. It wasn't like the other nations where you would choose a king based on power, based on military might, or anything like this, that it would all be about the heart of the king, that the heart of the king would be one who is after God's own heart. So the prophet also would be a check and balance as well for the king, that Israel might have a human king on the throne, but there is always a divine king, an ultimate sovereign king over them. Now we come to Samuel 8. And this is the issue, as they come rejecting the king. They come rejecting Yahweh as their king. Like I said before, that end verse in Judges, there was no king in Israel, and everyone did what was right in their own eyes. There were many kings. They didn't follow what God had commanded. There were many human kings. But now they come to Israel, and Israel say that they want a king. Actually, reject the idea of God as king, as the ultimate king. Judges also prepares Israel for a king. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes. There was no king. And Judges is the idea that every man is a king to himself. So, there's three issues that they come with this demand. So we have a problem, and they come with this demand, that they want a king like other nations. They were meant to be holy, they were meant to be set apart, but they just wanted to be like everyone else. We saw this, that maybe they weren't just like everyone else, they were worse than everyone else in the period of the Judges. And Deuteronomy 17:14 says, "When you come to the land the Lord your God has given you, and possess it, and dwell in it, and then say, I will set a king over me, like the other nations that are around me." This is something that was told before. This is what was going to happen. They're going to look to other nations and wish and seek to be exactly like other nations. But other nations don't have the one true living God. The second issue is that they, in verse 7, obey the voice of the people in all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them. Not only do they want to look like other nations, but they've rejected God as their own king. They've rejected this theocratic monarchy, the God-centered king, that God is their king. They rejected that God's timing would come to pass, that God would set his own king, choose his own king. Whereas they want to rush it, they want to have their own king, exactly like the other nations. But also, the third thing, and this comes up constantly throughout the Scriptures, is the issue of worship. Bad worship, wrong worship, and shifts its focus off God. We see this, that he says that they, from this day, they forsaking me and serving other gods, and they are doing to you. Again, it comes up frequently, the first commandment, that you shall, that I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. And yet they constantly want to be like other nations by worshiping other nations' gods, forsaking the God who actually rescued them, who saved them from the house of slavery. We don't know actually how long between chapter 7 and chapter 8. We don't really know this in detail. But isn't it quick how often it doesn't take but long for them to go from their heights of worshiping God, the true living God, and turn their own ways to follow other nations, to reject God as king, to serve other gods. It hasn't even passed a generation of Samuel. And they want to obey their own voice. Again, we've looked at this, that the voice is very important in Samuel. That who is going to listen to the voice of God? Who is actually going to listen to Yahweh? When the ark was left, it wasn't just the ark that left, it was the law of God that left as well. That the voice of God was not there. Who will obey the voice of God? But Samuel is now told to obey their voice. He's obeying God by obeying their voice, but they're the ones that get to choose, not God. But when trouble comes, Samuel, like his mother, when confronted with the issue, turns to prayer. When the thing displeased Samuel and they said, "Give us a king to judge us," Samuel prayed to the Lord. Isn't it still so fascinating that even in amongst this time when really we haven't seen a lot of the remnant in this dark and depressing time, there's not many people that jump out that are God-loving, loving God with all their heart, soul, mind, and strength. But here's Samuel still in amongst this. You know, how many times would he have met and dealt with these Israelites turning away from God, now building some more high places, serving other gods, and going time and time again trying to deal with these, seeing his sons walk away. But yet, there's still something that remains true to Samuel. He turns and he prays to God. How many times would you throw your hands up and say, "I can't do this anymore"? Because Samuel has a heart for prayer and knows that God is still his king and God is still powerful and sovereign over all. So we have a problem and they come now with a demand. And now Samuel gives them a warning. We see this in verses 10 to 18. So Samuel told all the words of the Lord to the people who were asking for a king from him. He said, "These will be the ways of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them to his chariots and to be his horsemen and to run before his chariots. He will appoint for himself commanders of thousands and commanders of fifties, and some to plow his ground and to reap his harvest and to make his implements of war and the equipment for his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive orchards and give them to his servants. He will take a tenth of your grain and your vineyards and give it to his officers and to his servants. He will take your male servants and female servants and the best of your young men and your donkeys and put them to his work. He will take a tenth of your flocks and you shall be his slaves. And in that day, you will cry out because of your king, whom you have chosen for yourself. But Lord will not answer you in that day." This is what a king will do. He will take, he will take, he will take, take, take. Now, I think maybe Americans might understand this a little bit better than me as an Australian. I still have a queen. You guys know, understand what it's like to have a king who would take and take with the Townshend Acts and things like this. And this is what the king will do. He will take your sons and turn them into soldiers. He will take your daughters and turn them into perfumers, cooks, and bakers. He'll take your field and your vineyard and your olive orchards, a tenth of your grain, your male servants, female servants. Take a tenth of your flocks. And you will be his slaves. Now, what did God do? God is their king. God is their king, said right before, you shall not serve any other gods besides me. He says, I'm the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. And here's what they're wanting when they want their own king. They want to go back into slavery. They want to not follow the king who rescued them from slavery. They want to follow their own king who will take them into slavery. But this is what they did, that God rescued them. We saw this even in verse 8, that according to all the deeds I have done from them, for the day I brought them out of Egypt, even to this day, forsaking me and serving other gods. But there's a grave warning which is given from Samuel to Israel. Verse 18, and in that day you will cry out because of your king. Not my king, your king. The one whom you have chosen for yourselves. You dig this hole, you got to get yourself out. But the Lord your God will not answer you in that day. What a grave situation. This is the warning of the king that they're choosing. They want a king like the other nations. They're going to get exactly what they want, a king like the other nations. Who's going to take everything? You're going to go from being free now to be slaves again. This is what you want? You can have it. So we go from a problem to a demand to a warning, now to an even bigger problem. In verses 19 to 22. But the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel, and they said, no, but there shall be a king over us, that we also may be like all the nations, that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. And when Samuel had heard all the words of the people, he repeated them in the ears of the Lord. And the Lord said to Samuel, obey their voice and make them a king. Samuel then said to the men of Israel, go every man to his city. They refused to obey the voice of Samuel. And why is this important? As it points out in this chapter that they're refusing God. But all Israel cannot look back. All Israel from Dan to Beersheba, chapter 3, verse 20 says, knew that Samuel was established as a prophet of the Lord. They knew he was a prophet of the Lord. And now they're rejecting his voice. They didn't want to obey the voice of Samuel. And they didn't want to obey the voice of God. They're rejecting Samuel. Therefore, they reject the Lord. Proverbs speaks of wisdom. If you turn at my reproof, behold, I pour out my spirit on you, and I will make my words known to you, because I've called you and you refuse to listen. I have stretched out my hand and no one has heeded, because you have ignored all my counsel and would not have none of my reproof. I also will laugh at your calamity. I will mock when terror strikes you, when terror strikes you like a storm and your calamity comes like a whirlwind, when distress and anguish come upon you. Then they will call upon me, but I will not answer. They will seek me diligently, but they will not find me. All because they refused to listen. They refused to obey the voice of Samuel, and therefore the voice of God. They were given this choice. They were given this warning. Do not go down this path. Do not make this decision. Their answer is no. We want a king like the other nations. Deuteronomy 18, verse 9 says, when you come to land that the Lord your God has given you, you shall not learn to follow the abominable practices of those nations. And again, further down in verse 14, it says, for these nations which you are about to dispose, listen to fortune tellers and to diviners. But as for you, the Lord your God has not allowed you to do this. Or even later, after this period in Ezekiel 20 to 32, says, What is your mind shall never happen. The thought, let us be like the nations, like the tribes and countries, and worship wood and stone. That this reveals a bigger problem. They want to be like other nations with a king, but really they want to be like other nations that worship other gods. Want to come and follow the abominable practices of those other nations. We'll see fortune tellers and diviners. That'll come up again in 1 Samuel. That they just want to be like the other nations, but the Lord did not allow them to do it. That when you follow to be like other nations who set other kings in place, you will become like those other nations. You reject God as your king, you will reject God as your God, and you'll start to worship other things, wood and stone, Ezekiel says. They want a king like other nations, but they also want a king that he may judge us. But this is something that God does. When Sarai and Abraham in Genesis 16, verse 5, it says, may the wrong done to me be on you. I gave my servant to your embrace. And when she saw that she had conceived, she looked at me with contempt. May the Lord judge between you and me. This is a role that God has done, who then appoints judges to be able to rule and to judge underneath him. Or Genesis 31:53, the God of Abraham and the God of Nahor and the God of the Father, but judge between us. Or Exodus 5:21, and he said to them, the Lord look on you and judge. This is something God does. They don't want a king. They don't want God to judge them. They want an earthly king who has earthly eyes, not a holy judge to judge them. Their third request, which reveals a big problem, is they want a king to go out and fight before us and fight our battles. But God had promised to them that he would fight their battles. Exodus 14:14 says, the Lord will fight for you, and you only have to be silent. That's what the Lord had promised that he would do. But no, they want a king like the other nations so that he might be able to go fight them. Or Deuteronomy 1:30, and the Lord your God who goes before you will himself fight for you, just as he did for you in Egypt before your eyes. Again, pointing back, he's the God who frees them. He's the one who fought for them. They didn't send the plagues. They didn't do anything. The Lord fought for them. He freed them. But you don't even have to go back that far before, the chapter before, in chapter 7. Samuel was offering up the burnt offering, and the Philistines drew near to attack Israel. But the Lord thundered with a mighty sound that day against the Philistines and threw them into confusion, and they were defeated before Israel. What a short memory that the Lord fought their battles. They tried it in chapter 4. It didn't work. The glory of the Lord departed. However, the Lord will fight their battles. And they did, and they saw it. This is why they want another king. They want a king to be able to fight their battles. Where's God? But ultimately, they're looking to an earthly king. They're looking to a king with all the physical appearances of the other kings around them. And the great problem is that they will get what they asked for. They will get this king like the other nations. We'll look at this next week and the following week. However, in the Bible, the seed planted that there is a king who will come, who is not a king with earthly eyes as a physical stature, but one who will rule God's kingdom. Christ is the king. Christ is king. Christ is king over the battle. Christ has fought our battles for us. Christ does not take or look like earthly kings. Instead of taking, Christ gives. Christ will judge us perfectly. He won't judge us like the earthly kings do, but He will do it with true justice. He will go before us. Again, Deuteronomy 17 speaks of the prophet, priest, and king. And when he sits on the throne in his kingdom, he shall write for himself a book of the copy of the law approved by the Levitical priests. And it shall be with him, and he shall read it in the days of his life, and he may learn to fear the Lord his God by keeping all the words of the law and these statutes that are doing them, that his heart may not be lifted up above his brothers, and that he may not turn aside from the commandment, neither to the right hand or to the left, so that he may continue long in his kingdom, and he and his children in Israel. That we are looking for this king to come, this king who will rule justly. We see another promise in 2 Samuel chapter 7. When the days are fulfilled, when God makes a covenant with David, looking towards that son of David, the stump of Jesse who will come. When your days are fulfilled and you lie down with your fathers, I will raise up for you your offspring after you, who shall come from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. Do they want a king like the other nations? Whereas Jesus is not like kings like other nations. He is completely different. They want the wrong thing. But they need Jesus. They need Jesus, the true king. That's why it's important when Matthew starts, Jesus begins to preach and he says, "Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand." That Jesus is that king to come, that king that fulfills those offices of prophet, priest, and king. He fights our battles for us. He conquers sin. He frees us from slavery rather than putting us into slavery. But Israel does not want that king. We'll look next week to who they choose to be their king. Secretly first and then outside of that. But
thank you for listening to this sermon from Seven Springs Presbyterian Church. If you want to learn more about us, please find us on Facebook or visit us at sevenspringspresbyterian.com. Seven Springs Presbyterian Church began in 1874 and is a congregation of the Presbyterian Church in America located in Glade Spring, Virginia. Please join us for worship on Sunday at 10 a.m. and 6 p.m. for His glory and His gospel.